Hello, I'm Eddie Mayer. This is the Eddie Mayer Interview Podcast.
I got into policing really on a whim initially. I actually flipped a coin. I was going to go backpacking around Europe because I was after adventure and something different. And I flipped a coin because I'd seen an advert in the newspaper and it came up heads. But
you didn't go best of three?
No, I didn't do that, no. I mean, it seems a flippant way to decide what to do.
It's literally flippant.
Yes.
But if I may, why backpacking or the police? Why not backpacking or becoming an acrobat or becoming a circus traveller?
Because it was something that was unpredictable. I don't know what's going to happen the next day. Something adventurous.
And that was based on what? Have you got policing in the family or?
No policing background at all.
So what was it, the Sweeney or?
No, I didn't really watch television particularly either. I used to read sort of almost a boy's own adventure type of attitude. My favourite fiction was C.S. Forrester's Hornblower or Patrick O'Brien's Aubrey Maturin novels. So for me, there was the sort of nobility of a flawed character drove my early days in the police, because once I did go in the police, I was there. I wanted to do the right thing. I wanted to do my duty and, you know, fight the good fight, really. That was very much behind what I wanted to do, despite my sort of flippant beginnings.
Did you want to save people?
Yes, absolutely. And I also wanted to catch bad guys, which, you know, is the driving force of many people who go into the police, especially at 19. I was quite naive, really.
And your folks were a little surprised.
Yeah, they were very surprised. They were obviously supportive. I think they were dubious about whether I would it would suit my personality. I was a sort of bookish introvert, really. It wasn't necessarily the natural thing to go into. And I did find it very hard.
So tell me about those early days. The training obviously didn't put you off?
No, the training was fine. My first time on my own in the streets of Derby, I found incredibly difficult. It took me a while to adapt to the sort of confrontation and how to manage confrontation. You know, I was quite a naive young man, really. I found it difficult, say, for example, with big burly men arguing outside a pub, the fact that I couldn't reason with them. So, you know, actually having to learn assertiveness and adapt to, you know, people with a very, very different background. It took me a long time to do in uniform, which I suppose it's perhaps one of the reasons why only 4 years into the job, when I had the opportunity to get into undercover work, I took to that.
Is that unusual? I don't know anything about how these things work, but at the age of, you'll have been, what, 24?
23. Oh, it was incredibly unusual, especially as the fact that the type of undercover work that I did hadn't really been happening in this country at all.
How did you hear about it? How did it come up, that sort of weird opportunity?
Well, as a matter of chance, I got an attachment. Yeah, an attachment to the Derbyshire Drug Squad. Now, they hated having us rookies as a month attachment because we were just people who didn't know what we were doing and got underfoot. So they didn't particularly like it. But one of them must have seen something in me because he said, well, do you want to have a go at buying some crack cocaine? Which I thought was a fairly unusual request, but I agreed. And he gave me £20 and I went to knock on someone's door and bought crack cocaine off this big gangster. It wasn't particularly difficult. You know, he asked me a few awkward questions, but not so awkward that I didn't walk away with a small wrap of crack cocaine. And that sort of shaped the next 14 years of my life, really.
What was your own personal relationship with that sort of illegal drug at that time?
Oh, none at all. I still remembered Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan telling the world that one smoke of crack cocaine and you would be addicted for life. And I was part of that majority who actually fell for all that rubbish. For me, this was a chance to do something really good because obviously, as we were told every day, that these nasty drug dealers were destroying our society.
And what about friends and relatives? Did you see any drugs? Were you aware of the effects and on a personal level before then?
I came across it to a degree when I was in Manchester. I was in college for a short time. I saw the birth of acid house and the dance music culture, but that was all quite positive, and I saw that as a completely separate thing to, you know, the sort of street level heroin and crack dealing.
So after that first door knock and you came away with some crack cocaine, you embarked on quite a journey. Tell me about how that began.
Well, from that point, I had a lot of success, and because of that,
what was success in those terms? Getting the crack cocaine.
Well, using my observation skills and sort of manipulation skills to gather evidence of conspiracy between different group a group of people. So I was successfully bringing down groups of gangsters in very quite short jobs. And there I ended up travelling around the counties of the Midlands and doing operations for other people. And I was in, you know, I was in quite a lot of demand.
You had a persona?
Yeah, I mean, I adapted it a little bit each time. But I mean, the first time I did it, I was just pretending to be a student. But quite often I would make myself out to be a bit of a travelling criminal, which is quite believable. It's quite normal. You have people going from city to city, sort of stealing cars and doing whatever crimes you can.
Did you have an outfit?
Well, when I was playing a sort of mid-level scally, yes, I would have sort of tracksuit bottoms. Depending on how wealthy I was, it would depend on what trainers I was wearing. You know, the criminal world really does have an eye for fashion and trainers. But sometimes I would play very low level, just one step above homeless, you know, really struggling with life. And that was often a very useful persona to play because you could be not noticed, you know, you can not really seen as a threat. As the jobs went on and the jobs got longer and longer, for example, eventually I was doing them sort of 6 months at a time. You know, I'd drop into a city and I would work a city for 6 months.
So you weren't going home every night, that's for sure.
No, I mean, I was spending sometimes two or three nights away. Sometimes I would go home. You know, I would get home at weekend and still take my kids swimming on a Sunday morning. But yeah, I was spending quite a lot of time away.
How much of a strain did that put on your family life?
Well, my family life was a touch tricky anyway. And when I was married, sometimes, certainly later on, I was actually had the odd situation where I was actually going working undercover and it was quite an escape from home and perhaps relieved some of the tension at home.
Did your job have a negative impact on your relationship at home?
From my point of view, I don't think it did. I think it actually eased the pressure in some ways, but the job did have an impact on me personally. I mean, for example, an operation I was working in Nottingham. It was an extremely tense job. But when you're existing on your wits and sort of thriving on adrenaline every day, it can have quite a cost on your body. And as I was getting older, I was getting sort of a dry face to the point that my skin and my face was even splitting and sort of weeping. So it was many, many years later that I suffered the effects of PTSD as a result of various aspects of my undercover work.
So I'm thinking just the other day I was in Southend and I saw on a bench in the town centre two people who I assumed to be drug addicts of some kind, and I could easily walk past. It was your job, presumably, to sidle up to them.
Yeah, it was my job to single out those people in an inner city who you wouldn't normally notice, and there is an enormous amount of street people. There's an entire community that goes on. And as the job got harder and harder, which it did, and this is an important point to make that I try and make in the book, is that over time, we more successfully police drugs, heroin and crack cocaine on the streets, and we always have to develop tactics, and that's what I did. I got involved in the teaching of, you know, the training of other people from the core work. But there is always a pushback from organised crime, and the pushback, the most successful tactic they can use, is the increased use of violence and intimidation. So in other words, the gangsters that can most successfully intimidate and terrify a community are the ones that are protected the most against police informants or undercover work. So over time, policing makes the gangsters nastier. So this made it harder to get to know them. So what I had to do is, like you said, those two people on the bench, I would befriend those. And I would spend some time befriending them and getting to know them. And I would manipulate them. Vulnerable people tend to be easier to emotionally manipulate than others. But that was the job. That was the decision I took, that the end justified the means. You know, undercover work is a very heavy-handed. It's the nuclear option of policing, really, because you can't go into anyone's life or any community without having a massive impact on those people.
And yourself, tell me about the increased danger that you believe the policy, the drugs policy, put you in.
Oh, God, I mean, the threat to my safety just got more and more over time. The gangsters got nastier. I remember working in Nottinghamshire and I was trying to infiltrate one side of the Colin Gunn organised crime group. And he let it be known, and we heard on many channels in the police intelligence that if he caught an undercover police officer, they would be murdered. They'd be tortured to death. This is the kind of information they put out all the time. And in fact, one day on that job, I'd managed to buy some crack off one of his lieutenants, but that was after a sort of 10 or 15 minute grilling where he had a knife pressed into my groin. I could feel the knife. So it was a very tense job, that one. But the real danger became clearer later on, because the day after that happened, I think two of my members of my team were actually off sick. So two people were brought in to provide that, to cover their roles, backup roles. And one of these people, when I met them in the morning, really made the hair stand up on the back of my neck. I just was not happy with this person at all. And as I've said, when you're living on adrenaline every day, you're sort of hypersensitive. Your perceptions are sensitized and almost to the point of paranoia. So I said to the other people I was working with, I'm sorry, I just do not want this guy knowing what I'm doing. Anyway, it turned out that was a useful bit of intuition, because 12 months later, it's a guy called Charlie Fletcher, he's in the news. He turned out to be an employee of the organised crime group that I was infiltrating. And he was paid £2,000 a month on top of his police wage to provide information to that organised crime group. And interestingly, later on when this came out, I was quite shocked. I shouldn't have been, because I spoke to various senior covert police, and their attitude was, well, of course this happens. With this much money involved, how can it not happen? So it's clear that the level of corruption that the illicit drug trade is causing is accepted by senior police.
Okay. What do you believe the level of corruption is?
Oh, well, it's huge. I mean, for example, an operation up in North Derbyshire, we had a briefing at the start of it where the senior officer there said, as a standing order on this job, do not speak to any officer at all from Greater Manchester Police. If anyone from Greater Manchester Police tries to speak to you about this job, you will note it down and contact the SAO immediately. And that's because it was quite clear that the people we were investigating, it wasn't safe to speak to Greater Manchester Police at all because of the level of corruption involved. And this is common all over the country.
The increasing spiral of danger that you faced, having to sing for your supper with a knife pressed against your groin. By the way, how did you do that?
It's just a matter of fronting everything out and never letting your cover slip.
And that obviously wasn't an isolated incident.
No.
He laughed.
No. I mean,
Was it sort of daily, weekly? I mean,
it's happened plenty of times. I mean, someone tried to run me over with a car. And in Stoke-on-Trent, I knocked on a dealer's door who I thought was completely happy with me. I'd been buying weights of heroin off him. He was a fairly well-placed middle management dealer. And he opened the door and put a samurai sword to my throat. He was accusing me of being drug squad and shouting. I could sort of spit flying into my face as he was shouting at me. And I really thought my time was up. I was a slight loss of what to say, if I'm honest. But then this woman just popped her head out from behind him and she started laughing. She said, I thought he was going to say he was then. And they were just winding me up. But you also have to bear in mind that they will only take so much risk. The risks that they take in terms of intimidation and violence are very much fit into their business model. I used to give evidence behind a screen. I used to have a pseudonym. I used to be anonymous. But now I've given up that anonymity. This is my real name. So people seem quite surprised at that. Well, I mean, I took the risk working undercover to do what I thought was right. So if there is a risk now, it's because I'm doing the right thing. But having said that, I'm not worried, because these people, these organised crime groups, use violence as part of their business model. And it's not in their interests to come looking for me now. There's no gain to be had in revenge.
Just thinking in terms of your recovery from PTSD, I'm just wondering how important having your own name is and not continuing in some way to having a false identity.
It possibly is, because, yes, having false identities does bring its own pressure. That's for sure. But I did used to manage that side of it fairly well, I think. In fact, I have to confess, I did enjoy the deception at times. It's a challenge to be able to deceive people and manipulate people around you. I mean, I had the end to reach. You know, it was part of an investigation. It was to actually catch people. But the actual process, yeah, it's... I enjoyed the work.
I mean, you were very good at what you did. You were in demand from forces across the country. What was the high point for you? You must have loved it at some point.
I had such mixed views on it because I enjoyed the work. I enjoyed the moments when I got success, but there was always that sort of incremental growing unease that what I was doing was actually futile. I mean, I knew very early on that the war on drugs couldn't be won and that it's a really daft concept. I knew that. But there was always more gangsters to catch, and the gangsters were always getting nastier, so I was in more in demand.